We're going to be focusing on what I have found to be a particularly provocative and helpful book, but I'm very much going to be approaching what that book is about from out of my present experience, which is being director of the processes by which the various social statements of the ELCA are being developed. And so during the 2 weeks that I'll be here at Holden, we'll be looking at some of those statements that are in process, both this week and next week. Tomorrow we'll be looking at a statement on abortion that was adopted last summer at our churchwide assembly, and I did bring some copies here because it might be helpful if some of you intend to come to that session tomorrow to have a chance to read it ahead of time. I'll also leave some copies in the Resource Center, which you can take, come and get copies of. Later on in the week, we'll be looking at a statement on the environment that's in its first draft form called Caring for Creation. And then later yet in the week, the first draft of a social statement on race, ethnicity, and culture. In addition to those, next week we'll be dealing in greater length with the sexuality study, which is probably the thing we're doing that has generated the most controversy and the most correspondence and all the rest. And in many ways, it's related to the sexuality study and the various dynamics that that results in that has drawn me especially to the book that we'll be looking at this afternoon. Let me indicate that this book, namely James Davison Hunter's Culture Wars, The Struggle to Define America, is one that unfortunately the bookstore didn't get to order because for some reason my book order never actually got to them. But it this is what the book looks like.
Do you know if it's in paper yet?
No, it's not yet in paper. It was published in 1990. I don't think it is. I mean, it's only been less than a year that it's been out, so I doubt if it's in paper. Sitting in the position that I do right now, after having served in the local parish and also having been a professor at the Lutheran Seminary in Chicago for a few years, sitting as I do now in the churchwide offices, and particularly dealing with these issues that are inevitably controversial kinds of issues, not only in the church, but in the wider society, I'm impressed again and again by the way in which the zing of arrows seem to be crisscrossing in front of me. And particularly in correspondence that I receive, some of them 50 in one day, there will be strident voices from one side condemning this group to hell and strident voices from the other side saying just the opposite. Or people who have read the same document or who read the same Bible, who certainly are getting much different things and much different impressions from out of what they have read or discussed together. And it seems as though that dynamic is not unique to the church, but it is a part of the crisis that we're facing in our society, with one commentator after another raising the question, is there any common ground that unites us? In the church, we might say, well, at least we have some common beliefs that unite us, that we, you know, confess every Sunday and that we have heard throughout our upbringing in the church. But increasingly, on some of these highly divisive social issues of our day, even those common beliefs, we discover, have implications that are understood very, very differently by people, even those people who might be a part of one congregation, much less one church body. And so what I have found particularly interesting, and I'm not going to be talking about the substance of the sexuality study other than indicating this is the document I'm talking about, is that responses to this have been particularly interesting in terms of what they reveal about the polarization in our society, and a polarization that unfortunately also affects the church in some very painful ways at times. the glue, the symbols, the structures, the public moral understandings, and even the political leaders that might to some degree have stirred and united us in the past seem to be absent to a large degree from the present scene. Much of the rhetoric that seeks to provide some unity often turns out to be either superficial or reinforces the polarizations aided and abetted by particularly the sound bites of the media. Attempts are quickly made to associate any would-be spokespersons with either the pro-life or the pro-choice camp, with the conservative or the liberal camp, with evangelical Catholics or multiculturalists, two of the camps sometimes identified in the ELCA, with the defenders of the free market or the defenders of a regulatory state, identifying people as either the defender of white middle class male interests or defenders of the interests of those who are poor and or people of color. And so what often happens in our society is that those on the opposing sides end up being caricatured by the other side, and often caricatured according to certain hardened ideological types. Suspicions of ideological, political, or partisan motives often overshadow genuine attempts to seek the common good. That, I think, is a kind of litany that we sense going on again and again in our society. And so that larger concern of rebuilding the common good is certainly a large part of what motivates me to be interested in this. Part of it is just, you know, trying to say, well, how do I survive in the midst of those competing arrows? But I think it is related to the wider crisis in our society that all kinds of different commentators have talked about in recent years. Certainly one of the most well-known of those would be Robert Bella and Company's Habits of Heart, of the Heart, and now The Good Society, but a number of other treatments that have also looked at that particular problem in our society. And so it's against that backdrop that Hunter sets forth his analysis. He contends that America is in the midst of a culture war that has and will continue to have reverberations not only in terms of our public policies, but also in terms of the ordinary daily life of most of us. He says, our national identity and purpose have not been more a source of contention than at any time in our history since the time of the Civil War. Now that's a rather dramatic claim. And I think part of what I want to help us to see is some of the basis on which he makes that kind of claim. This culture war is a struggle over the power to define social reality. In other words, our sense of meaning and of purpose. At stake is how we as Americans will order our lives together, or, in other words, what constitutes the good society. And so I think he makes a very persuasive case of how previous categories are not that adequate. He says, we're not talking about simply a conservative versus liberal kind of split. It's not a split that we can describe religiously in terms of the usual categories of Protestant, Catholic, and Jew, with lots of different denominations who can be differentiated according to their belief or their positions on various issues. But it's a war that cuts across a lot of these denominational distinctions. So for example, those in one camp who are Roman Catholic may have a lot more in common with American Baptists than they do with some other Roman Catholics or vice versa. Certainly this was very true at the National Workshop on Christian Unity that I was presenting at a couple of months ago. Those of us who have been involved with sexuality issues in the Episcopal Church and the chair of the Presbyterian study, we were all together trying to make a case for the fact that what each of us are dealing with has far more in common with one another in terms of the dynamics within our own church bodies than differences between the church bodies on some of these issues. Hunter contends that the real religious battles of our day are no longer in terms of theological or ecclesiastical differences, but what is at stake are different understandings of public morality. This is emerging as the new ecumenical challenge. So it's not a matter of saying, well, let's see, does this argument go back to St. Paul or to Luther or to different pictures of Jesus, although quite frankly, different pictures of Jesus are at stake in this. It's not a matter of saying, how do we, you know, have all these theological dialogues to try to resolve the differences among us. But it is a struggle that, if anything, is rooted in how we understand some of the legacy of the Enlightenment and how we not only view that, but how we value that. What is at stake are different systems of moral authority and understanding, and they're so different at times that the possibility of even having some touchstones or some points of dialogue becomes an utterly frustrating kinds of experiences, because the way in which moral categories function end up being like two ships passing in the night, and with very difficult time trying to find some common ground or some connecting points. Basic commitments and beliefs and identity are at stake, which is why there often is such passion and such ultimacy connected with these conflicts. Hunter tries to suggest why there is such ultimacy to these conflicts, and he says, well, it's a lot of it's connected with economic changes, moving from an industrial-based economy to a knowledge-based economy. It has to do with changing roles of all kinds of groups in our society, changing roles of women, changing institutions, and the fact that, therefore, when the social order around us is changing, it becomes very threatening. And there's all kinds of dynamics of insecurity that causes people to say, you know, at least I know for sure who I am in terms of how I interpret my world, and therefore what I have to cling to in order to give me a sense of some stability when everything around me seems to be changing. The conflict typically is framed in rhetoric that is absolute, comprehensive, and ultimate. That is, it is in a sense religious, even for those people who might not think of themselves as particularly religious. Scientific evidence or logical arguments can do little to change the minds of those who are so committed. Typical response I've read many times in recent weeks: don't give us that scientific data, because my mind's made up. The Bible is clear. Don't bring in science. That'll only cloud things. Now, from that same person, a little bit later in the same response form, they'll say, well, of course, I know, for example, that homosexuals can be changed. That's scientifically provable. And so, you know, again, then science all of a sudden gets pulled back in. But the way in which certain categories become absolute and reinforce the two different worldviews that are at stake in this culture wars. What has become sacred to those in one moral community is viewed as desecration to those in the opposing camp. And so there will very frequently be charges that I'll read as saying, well, you know, this is kind of the movement of Satan in our church to even suggest that we might open up some of these questions about how we understand sexuality. And certainly forces on the other side saying, well, there's those absolutistic proto-fascists who are trying to tell me how I should live my sexual life. And to realize within one church body how strong those differences can be expressed is more than I want to stomach at times. Let me just share with you the way in which some of these come through. And these are what I've pulled here are some responses from members of the ELCA that I've read. These are not the most strident ones, okay? Because I want you to get a little bit of the more nuanced difference in these two polar tendencies. So these are direct quotes from just a few response forms I was reading just the other day. On the one side are comments such as the following. The Bible has all the answers. Don't change or question what the Bible clearly says. If you do so, you're only caving into the world, giving in to all that secularized morality. God has not changed his mind. There are absolute moral rules that don't change no matter what society thinks. Don't give us that scientific stuff. You're only using it as an authority to displace the Bible. On the other hand, we hear comments like these. The church should quit telling people how to behave sexually. Let them make their own decisions. Those antiquated notions in Scripture need to be dispelled. The church needs to come to grips with what's going on in people's real lives. Or this from the age of a, or this from the, in the words of a 72-year-old widow. I don't think at my age I've come to believe that there are no right answers. Times have changed and will change again. After all, we're created to enjoy and delight in what God creates, so let's do it. This is from a 72-year-old widow, just to destroy your stereotype, whether you lest you assume that one voice is always younger and one is older. Now, Hunter uses two labels for these tendencies, and he admits that they're inadequate. I haven't even put them up there because, again, we get into labeling, and then I think it becomes unhelpful, but I'll just tell you what the labels he uses. He uses the labels orthodox and progressive. In the orthodox tendency, in that tendency, what predominates, and I have some of this listed up here on the board, is a commitment to an external, definable, and transcendent authority with unchangeable values, purpose, and identity. It is an authority to which one must surrender one's intellect and one's will. Don't question, just obey. Go along with it. It's God's word, it's God's will. Moral truths are non-negotiable. In the progressive tendency, I, by the way, intentionally put that first one on the left and the second one on the right so that we shake up our categories a little bit here. In the progressive tendency, truth is a process or a reality that is ever unfolding. Historic faiths are to some degree re-symbolized according to the prevailing assumptions of contemporary life. In other words, thinking through how the faith, how the traditions and symbols of the faith apply to contemporary situations. This particular sexuality study certainly reflects the progressive view in this sentence. Morality is never a settled package of what is considered right or wrong. Now, that simple sentence, inserted in the study, by the way, at the suggestion of one of the outstanding ethicists of our church, who's also been a favorite of Holdenites in the past, that particular sentence has probably stirred up more ire among those who Hunter would classify as orthodox than has any other sentence in this particular study. Another way of getting at the distinction here is to use the terms a tightly bounded moral community, which is what this first column would represent, or a loose bounded community, an emphasis on the liberation of the individual. In a 1987 survey of religious leaders, those who were Orthodox and those who were progressive in each denomination surveyed divided consistently along anticipated lines on a wide range of issues. Family issues of premarital sexual relations, cohabitation, the Equal Rights Amendment, abortion, homosexuality, economics, law, education, science, government, and the U.S. role in international relationships. The Orthodox progressive continuum accounts for more variation within and across religious tradition than does any other single factor, according to that 1987 study, including factors like gender or race or class or geographic, demographic kinds of factors. The associations and alignments arising out of this new ecumenism seek to marshal resources against the cultural assumptions that the other side represents, and usually in ways that cut off the possibility of there being real dialogue. It's been interesting to read in a recent Christian Century the reflections of a man who almost became the president or I forgot what the title is, but the head of the Disciples Church, because it was clear that the single issue on which he was defeated was his particular stated position on homosexuality. And so he reflects on he doesn't call it culture wars, but the extreme reactions that are widespread, which he calls relativism and absolutism. Both extremes contribute to our politicization and undermine the possibility of genuine leadership. Those who believe they have a firm grasp on God's will look for leaders who will parrot their convictions, and those who have deep doubts that we can ever know God's will with any confidence look for leaders who will parrot their political agenda. Both groups subvert genuine leadership marked by openness to the will of God. A quote from Michael Kinneman. Robert Bella, who has also, I think, been intrigued in a recent article I read, intrigued by Hunter's analysis, puts it this way. The Orthodox see the progressives as enemies of Western civilization or even agents of Satan. The progressives see the Orthodox as proto-fascists determined to destroy the Bill of Rights and democratic freedom. And so in the midst of this, how can we find and maintain commonly held symbols and meanings that will make our collective life in this society possible? I'd like for us to spend a few minutes at this point commenting on that analysis and perhaps identifying some of the places where you see this culture war raging. I could go into some of the areas that Hunter describes, but let me just indicate that his book discusses how these occur in terms of various family issues, you know, issues of what constitutes the family, authority, inclusive language, obligation, particular obligation of bearing as well as rearing children, and certainly questions of sexuality and what is considered natural and what is considered deviant. Certainly it rages in terms of education, with some on one side saying, well, all our schools are doing now is supporting secular humanism, and others on the other side pleading for non-sectarianism, or certainly a lot of the politically correct kinds of controversies that are raging in our day. Around media and the arts, a lot of the free speech and censorship kinds of debates, in terms of law and the way in which cultural questions more and more end up becoming juridical kinds of questions. And obviously also in terms of electoral politics, and especially the way in which any real substantial arguments get turned again and again into sound bites, and the substance of those arguments often lost. Let me just throw in another example, because it's one that I found particularly intriguing. It's really caused me to do this analysis of every piece of direct mail appeal I get. And if you're like me, you get lots and lots of those in the mail every day. And he describes how through the technology of public discourse and the way in which that plays itself out, so direct mail includes feigned familiarity, you know, dear Karen, oh, well, how does this person know me? A sense of urgency, you know, has in the front, you know, oh, you know, you may be a winner, or, you know, urgent, you know, it makes it look like you've got a big check in there. And the manipulation of emotions that can occur in some of those direct mail appeals, aim to somehow the letter is aimed to stir up those who are likely already to be on the side of that particular organization. And in many cases, describing there's a kind of devil factor that gets played up, you know, of, oh, watch out, the other side's going to destroy your rights, or the other side's going to destroy the moral fabric of society. And I have to admit that groups that I have been inclined to support in the past, now when I realize what's going on, I say, oh, well, you know, there, you know, isn't there a little hyperbole going on here? And, you know, realizing that the way in which the other side is cast as enemy, you know, again and again in very strident ways. And especially catching myself up short when I realize, hey, you know, I've been oblivious to that in the past, of the way in which they're really painting things to be extra bad in order to maybe not get me to contribute, but at least to build up a sense of this side's camp and this side's supporters. The other example that I would throw in there is the way, and tomorrow we'll be talking about the adopted ELCA abortion statement. But after that was adopted, it was just incredible the way in which the media tried to interpret it, and mostly got it wrong at first, trying to put it quickly in either a pro-life or pro-choice kind of camp. And you know, that was a whole interesting experience of helping them to understand. I think finally some of them started to get it right, so that a couple of weeks ago after the Supreme Court decision, I was dealing with reporters from Associated Press, UP, and CBS, all of whom were saying, well, you know, some church bodies are trying to find some middle ground. Tell us how the ELCA's statement might be a contribution to that public discussion. But again, that's, you know, at first this kind of determination to put something in one camp or the other, and that's the only way that it somehow can be handled. So let's spend just a few minutes reacting to this and maybe sharing some of your perceptions of how you see this operating, or some of your questions or challenging as to whether this is an accurate analysis of what's going on.
Given this background that you presented, where does the call or the need, what's the historical background of that, so that a national church body issues social statements? And then after they're issued, what's sort of the vision of how they're used? And you gave one good example already.
Let me try to respond briefly to that. The social statements that we are working on now have, for the most part, been in response to requests that have come through synod assemblies and through the churchwide assembly or church. And so, in many ways, they are initiated more at the grassroots, or the request for that. And typically what happens is a task force will meet for some time and work on these social statements. They are intended, once adopted, well, and one of the things that we're really committed to doing in the ELCA is to make those processes as participatory as possible along the way. That at first is reflected in the attempt to have a task force that's not just composed of theologians, but practitioners, as well as common ordinary folk who live with these issues day in and day out, and then to invite response to studies or first drafts early on so that there's opportunity for congregations to participate and provide input long before something appears at a churchwide assembly for adoption. Once adopted, they are the official position of the church, but again, that should not be interpreted in too heavy-handed a way. For the purpose of public policy advocacy, they provide the basis of, yes, this is the church's position on that particular matter. They should not, though, be seen as binding on the conscience of individual believers. They're intended to guide Christians in their decision-making about that issue, but not in a way that is intended to make people feel that somehow they're less a member of this church body if they happen to come out at a place different from where that social statement is. Does that answer your question to some degree? I think one of the things of trying to listen to these different voices in terms of how we're trying to develop social statements in the ELCA is that can to some people sound like a, well, lowest common denominator, middle of the road kind of, or fence straddling kind of thing. And I think at times that may be a valid kind of charge. But another way of looking at that, I think, is to say that if in fact the diagnosis is correct that says one of the central problems in our society today is this lack of common public discourse around some of the central issues, then I think a very important role of the church can be that of trying to identify some values that we have in common, some wider parameters within which there's likely to be some continuing disagreement. And therefore, I think a proactive role of the church can be to try to forge some common ground, and that needn't be seen only as a kind of refusing to take a stand, but a stance that if anything may go against the stance that's so pervasive out there in society, namely a stance of polarizing everything and making people choose sides and kind of eclipsing whatever middle ground or whatever possible ground middle ground there might be, and it's usually in the middle somewhere that most people in our country are, not necessarily where the public media casts us as being.
Would you say, following on that statement, are the folks in the middle because the middle is where they really are, or are they in the middle because they simply can't figure out either of the two ends?
That's a good question. What's your suspicion about that?
I think there's a significant number of people that are in the middle because they simply can't figure out either of the two ends.
Yeah,
not out of any great
or else
sense
they,
of commitment or understanding of the issue.
Oh, okay, okay. Well, and I think for some people, you know, we're dealing with problem areas where there are competing moral claims. And therefore, to say, well, it's all one way or it's all another way, doesn't quite fit with how people read the situation and their own sense of what is moral, what is ethical in the midst of a complex reality. And so, in fact, they may be have a better reading of the situation than the more strident, polarized expressions on one side or the other.
Well, it sounds to me like you're saying different things. That Karen is saying, because it's complex, if you understand what's going on, you're likely to end up somewhere in the middle to see both sides. But that's different than, I haven't a clue, so I'm not going to take a stand. And consequently,
yeah,
looking
yeah,
like
right,
you're in the middle.
Right.
So you may have intuited something about the situation, namely that both extremes are wrong, but mm-hmm. But to do that because you have a clue rather than because you
right.
understand that is a different thing.
Yeah.
The middle as neutrality or nonpartisanship
yeah.
rather than the middle as
ambiguity.
Where I am by mm-hmm. conviction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that came to me when you were talking about the mail, the things that you read in the mail that come to you, you know, these pleas for how there has to be urgent action because the other side is coming crashing through our front doors. I think that happens because, in part, because each of the ends, each of
the poles.
Yeah, each of the poles are trying to jumpstart this population in the middle that looks complacent.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so it's mm-hmm. like in the state of Oregon, there's the Oregon Citizens Alliance, which is an organization that's trying to gather people together to make sure that homosexuality and pedophilia, bestiality,
necrophilia,
and sadomasochism are all lumped together as deviant sexual behaviors. There are gay rights groups primarily who are trying to ensure the rights of gay men and lesbians and bisexual folks. And so these two ends are competing fiercely for the public's attention and sees this huge population of Oregonians who haven't thought about the issues or whatever. And so both of them, the Oregon Citizens Alliance, are saying things like, you know, homosexuals are teaching your children how to be homosexual and using all of the scare tactics as far as that. And the gay and lesbian community is saying the Oregon Citizens Alliance are neo-fascists and all that kind of stuff. So I think that the pleas on both sides are just trying to, because both these sides feel so passionately about the issue, trying to divide this huge majority into one camp or the other so that there can be a winner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I want to be clear, I'm not wanting to be harshly judgmental about those tactics either. I mean, obviously I have proclivities that tend to go in one direction more than the other, and I can see why, in fact, the strategies are chosen there. It's you know, what I think Hunter does a really incredible job of trying to lay out the struggle as neutrally as possible. In fact, you read it and you really say, well, let's see, where does he come out on this? I think he's done some subsequent writing since then that may give more indication, but you know, to try to say, how can we just understand how it is? Obviously, to convince folks on one side of, well, you know, you just got to change your tactics and all the, you know, this other stuff, well, you know, the response would be, what do you mean? You think we're fools? You know, we're going to let them, you know, continue to carry the day on this issue without doing anything to counter that on the other side? In other words, it's a whole kind of structure of competition that gets set up, and so you know, it's not just a matter of saying, "Oh, well, let's just end the culture warfare, and then it'll be over."
What is an interesting question. To what extent is the whole concept of winner a piece of this?
Oh, yeah.
The point is, to went.
Yeah. Well, see, and this is where, and let me just say something, because I think one of the reasons I'm presenting this is I think there's lots of places, you know, the place where I work, the place, and including places like Holden, where we can really become captive to one or the other of these poles and get frozen into some ideological stuff. And even those of us who might be saying, hey, we're really for peace, we really want to, you know, we're for peace, we're for justice, and yet there are some real dynamics of warfare that break out in the middle of this too, you know, because of, you know, we feel so strongly about this cause or that cause, etc.
Go ahead. Well, I was just wondering if maybe part of the problem is that these have to do with balances, not so much of one issue trying to decide if pole A is right, pole B is wrong, or pole B is right, pole A is wrong, or more like a struggle between different types of moral issues and which one's more important, like in censorship, in music. Some people feel that these freedom of speech issues are so important that they're more important, a moral issue, than, say, what the people are saying. And say, rap music, where there's a lot of question about lyrics, you know, people find the lyrics to be, some people find the lyrics to be inciting all sorts of evil. And the fighting sides, in a sense, are saying not so much what is right and what is wrong, but which moral thing is the most important. And they're saying, some people are saying, well, the most important thing is freedom of speech, therefore, even though this is a bad thing for these people to say, we shouldn't keep them from saying it.
Yeah, I think that's an important point. And certainly that would, for most people who are somewhere in the broad middle between those, I would say that is what you're saying is particularly true. I think part of the difficulty is the kind of a passion that becomes connected with one pole or the other. It means that one point gets raised so much that what it has priority over gets lost from sight at time. You're also quite right in that Hunter indicates this is more than just, you know, a struggle of what is right and what is wrong. I mean, obviously the extremes on one side or the other say, hey, this is right and this is wrong. But it, you know, he's wanting to make a case for it being different moral understandings that are at stake, and therefore different ways that we put together that thing, you know, the priority of what should have value over what, and how do those differing worldviews get put together. Chuck, do you have it?
Well, it's a fascinating subject to me, the battle within the church in particular, since the Vietnam War days and the values struggle that was going on around the amnesty debate is one that I remember in particular as having a lot of what I take it Hunter's book is talking about between progressives and the Orthodox defenders of values. But some of the conversation in the last few minutes has suggested, I think, that there are kind of equally organized poles in the church, equal strength. And I think, ironically, I don't think that's the case. I think there is something to the charge that most of the mainline denominations people, including thee and me, who've been engaged in this activity, are in the progressive camp for whatever reason, that they just surface as people who are interested in doing social analysis, social change advocacy, or social policy development. Mm-hmm. I think that is true. Mm-hmm. They are the kind of people who surface. And not only staff, but also the people who tend to get elected to those boards, and the people who tend to bring resolutions to synod assemblies, pushing some particular social statement agenda. Mm-hmm. Whereas what may in fact be a majority of the church's members don't get organized to push their pull. Maybe they eventually do, but they don't take the initiative to organize because they think the Orthodox position is where the church has always been and they're comfortable with that, and why organize to change it? So I think there is something to that general charge, that at least in the mainline denominations, including the Roman Catholics, the people who are given custody of the social policy development agenda are progressives, not the Orthodox, in Hunter's terms. If that is the case, then the question would be, how does a church body practice fairness and justice? I think that's the real question that you posed. How do you, in fact, get everybody involved? Not only the other extreme, but all that vast middle group. How do they get involved? I can remember when in the old ALC we were developing a policy statement on anti-apartheid strategies, and particularly the issue of divestment. There were a lot of organized groups promoting divestment, but we couldn't find any organized groups promoting, at that time, promoting non-divestment. They just didn't exist. And I think, well, that was true in the early days of the amnesty debate too, back in the early 70s and mid-70s. There were groups promoting amnesty for Vietnam War, those who refused to go. And were in legal difficulty. There were no organized groups opposed to amnesty, but there were large numbers of people opposed to amnesty. And so I think it's difficult to envision the terrain as one of equally organized poles or extremes. Right. On the one
in
hand,
a wider society, that might be more true, but I think you're quite right.
In the church, I don't think it is true.
Well, and in some, I think in some denominations, unfortunately, it's also fortunate. Well, you know, again, depending on perspective, but I think that is, there is more organizing on both sides in some, particular some denominations that have been hit with some pretty
probably
sharp
divisions.
Probably
on abortion more than most other current issues.
Yeah, that would probably be the. Yeah, that would probably be one of the key ones. Yeah, but I think generally,
the death penalty,
I think
would be another example of how those who've gotten organized tend to be those who want to change the present situation in the U.S., which is support for the death penalty. So there are groups organized against it. But there aren't many groups organized to maintain the status quo, I don't think. At least in our church, I don't think there are.
Can that suggest something else? And I don't know if Hunter talks about this, but we talked about being a litigious society. I think also the fact that we assume that whenever there's a question, you vote, leads to the suggestion that there are winners and losers. Because when it comes to voting, it's yes or no. There's no, well, I object to this for these reasons, but if you're willing to do it and address my reasons, then go ahead. You know, it's never an essay question in the vote, in the booth. You know, it's always yes or no. And consequently, we get the notion that it's, that there are two sides to every question. There are only two sides, and one of them's wrong and one of them's right. So the debate is about which is wrong and which is right, not about the whole array of questions. And I would hope that the church would be a place where we could get beyond that structural situation. Unfortunately, when we do things like social teaching statements, eventually it does come to a vote. But at least the ones that we've done so far in the ELC, I think, give room for people to vote and have a difference of opinion, to agree in their vote and to have a difference of opinion.
Plus there's also a feature, which was in terms of the procedure on social statements, so that there is the possibility of an addendum expressing the view of a significant minority that felt differently than.
Right.
Which again at least gives more of a sense than just a flat yes and no, and either people agreed with this in total or didn't, but there were some who felt such and such needed more emphasis. Let me just share a few more thoughts along this line. I was going to invite you to do an exercise together with one another, but I think what I'll share with you might provide the basis for you to do that in some of your conversations around the village in the next few days. As I think I've implied already, each side in this debate or war tends to use the Bible or theology to support or justify positions that they hold. It's not that one is biblical and the other one isn't, even though there may be a sense in which one position might more readily say, well, ours is the biblical position, or ours is the Christian position. And I think it's important for us to be aware of how ideological presuppositions, how our own biases, in other words, inform how we turn to the Bible and theological traditions. And I think that's not just a matter of being able to discern the biases in that other position, but be honest about the biases that inform our own, the way in which we use the Bible in presenting our case. And how our own experiences have significantly influenced the worldviews or the ideological frameworks that we turn to. But the difficulty is that those experiences, or those stories, if you will, are seldom what we share with one another. Those often become too vulnerable to share with one another, and so it's very tempting then to retreat and to take these kind of ready-made categories to use, to say, well, this is the way it is, and I kind of line up behind that category, and I don't have to necessarily expose who I am and my experiences that have shaped and influenced my worldviews. It's easier to align ourselves with certain camps and to parrot the answers associated with such, even at times, I think, in places like Holden, than it is to think through the issues ourselves, and especially if thinking through that means having to reflect also on how our own pains and our own experiences have affected the positions that we take. Instead, we often attack others or defend ourselves as a means of protecting our own identity. And so whenever that happens, the warfare ends up getting perpetuated, even sometimes in the name of some of the good and righteous causes that we are claiming to defend or support or do advocacy for. I wanted to also just take note of a couple of other things that I had up here in terms of how some of these operate in different kinds of realms of discourse. This being the Orthodox tendency, tends to emphasize the importance of economic freedom, and particularly freedom in terms of free enterprise, and justice as righteous living. What does it mean to live according to God's law, to live according to God's righteous will? And I think this is especially important for people around Holden who have give a lot of importance to phrases like freedom and justice. And what I want to show here is how the two are really flip sides of one another in terms of these two poles. The progressive side over here tends to talk about freedom in terms of individual rights or the rights of various social groups within our society, and tends to talk about justice more in terms of economic justice or in terms of equity. So as you can see, there's a real flipping around here in terms of where economics fit in and where individual rights and therefore the way in which the language that we use, and I think this is especially true when I was teaching at the seminary, having to continually remind students to unpack what is the operational theology that is operating with parishioners. You know, what do they mean by, you know, what do they understand by some of the words that you might load all kinds of theological meaning onto, but they may have very different notions of what those words mean. So those are, I think, just some additional handles for understanding what that is all about. Let me just close with a passage from Ephesians. Before I do that, let me indicate that I do have copies of the abortion statement that we'll be discussing tomorrow. Also, you might spread the word around the village. We're working on a message dealing with some of the current issues related to death and dying, particularly physician-assisted death, withholding nutrition, and refusing beneficial treatment. And if some of you or others in the village that you know of who are here this week are involved in the healthcare professions, are involved in terms of giving particular attention to these issues, I have a limited number of copies of this draft along and would be willing to invite some of you to share some comments on it while you're in the village. Let me just quickly mention this, read this one passage of Ephesians 2, because to me it's important to think about what we've been saying and the kind of totally up in the air kind of state that we often feel like in our society, and I think also in the church, in the midst of the divisiveness that's there. And that's where I find the words from, the words in second chapter of Ephesians helpful. But now in Christ Jesus, you who once were far off have been brought near by the blood of Christ. For he is our peace. In his flesh he has made both groups into one and has broken down the dividing wall, that is, the hostility between us. Seems as though that becomes the basis for the church taking very seriously that culture wars are simply not the end of things, but there's reason for us to hang in there and to somehow find ways to move beyond the culture wars in our society as well as in our church. Thank you.